You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening, folks. My name is Cristobal Alex. I'm a program officer with the Democracy and Power Fund here at the Open Society Foundations. Thanks so much for coming out tonight, particularly during a nor'easter. It's great to see so many folks in the middle of the storm. And I think it's indicative of just how important redistricting is to see this many people in the audience. The midterm elections are just 19 days away. Those elections, coupled with the results of the 2010 census, will be factored into the next redistricting cycle. And as you will soon hear from our esteemed panelists, that redistricting cycle will impact the country and the direction of the country in profound ways. For one thing, the redistricting cycle will influence public policy at all levels of government for the next decade, from the local school board to Congress. Many months ago, Lali Esfahani, the director of our Transparency and Integrity Fund, who you will hear from soon, together with Erlen Ebrick of our Strategic Opportunities Fund and others here at the Open Society Foundations, under the direction of Ann Beeson, embarked on a cross-fund effort to develop a redistricting strategy. And the reason why we launched it as a cross-fund effort is because we realize that redistricting truly impacts all of our priority areas, and by definition, the very good work of our grantees. Whether we're talking about voting rights, whether we're talking about criminal justice and prison gerrymandering, whether we're talking about an open and transparent government, or a vibrant and strong democracy where we can all participate, redistricting is key to all of those issues. And tonight, we'll hear from some of the nation's leading experts on redistricting. Before we begin the program, I want to make two quick notes. The first is that tonight's event is being recorded for podcasting. And the second is a very quick welcome to Tai Merey Nickel, who is the young lady in the very front right row there. As of about 5 days ago, Tai is my fiancée. She accepted after a lot of deliberation. Thank you. I'm glad you're here tonight, Tai, and I'm glad you said yes. You'll see soon why so many of us at OSI and elsewhere have spent countless hours on this issue. It's just such a key issue. And now that I've sufficiently embarrassed the both of us, I'll turn back to it. We're going to start tonight's program with a discussion from a filmmaker, Jeff Reichert, and we'll talk about his film, Gerrymandering, which is receiving accolades and awards and will be released tomorrow in theaters. And then following that discussion from Jeff and the showing of various clips from his film, we'll have a panel discussion that will then be followed by questions from the audience. Jeff Reichert is a writer and director who recently served as vice president of Magnolia Pictures, where he developed release campaigns for some of the most successful documentaries in recent years. These include the Academy Award nominees Capturing the Freedmans, Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, Jesus Camp. Jeff, that Jesus Camp actually scared the bejesus out of me. I hope gerrymandering isn't quite as scary. And the award-winning Man on Wire. His most recent project, and the reason we're here tonight, is his film Gerrymandering, which has been showing around the country on the film festival circuit. Just a few things about the film before we get started. Bob Mondello from NPR, All Things Considered, calls it riveting. New York Magazine calls it an exceptionally entertaining film. Paul Constant from The Stranger, one of my favorite magazines, calls it every American voter should see this. Matt Thomas from The New York Examiner says, if you care about the future of America, see this movie. And finally, Stan Hall at The Oregonian says, a film seemingly made for Jon Stewart's Restoring Sanity movement. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Jeff Reichert.
Yeah, gerrymandering is not scary, for those who are wondering. It's actually, I like to think of it as a comedy of errors, or maybe more of a tragic comedy. But So anyway, thanks for coming. I'm really flattered to be introducing the issue, given that we have all sorts of folks in the room who know the policy a lot better than I do. but I'm going to give you a quick rundown of what redistricting is, what gerrymandering is, why we should care about it. I hope it's not too basic, because I'm going to start from the very beginning. So essentially, what this is about, the political power in our Congress is based around population. That's how it was set up. The Founding Fathers, they decided that, you know, we would do representation based on population. And so bigger states are awarded with more seats in Congress than smaller states. I think we all know that. You know, so after the census, which we do every 10 years, we do what's called reapportionment. There's a calculation that is done, and they take the total population, they figure out how many seats each state gets. So, and as states grow in population, they get more seats, and they take those seats from states that grow less quickly. So in this round, we might see something like Michigan losing 2 seats and some of those seats migrating down to Texas, which is projected to get maybe 3 or 4 seats. Anybody know? Something like that. So after the reapportionment, then the states now have to deal with the fact that they may have new seats, they may have lost some seats, but either way, their population has changed, even if they keep the same amount of seats, and so they have to redraw the districts because the districts are supposed to be as equal as possible within the state. So this is called redistricting, and the United States of America is, as far as I know, the only advanced Western democracy where politicians are directly able to draw the district lines. I think they're able to do it in something like, again, maybe somebody knows this number better than I do, but somewhere around 46 states, something like that, where the politicians kind of have unfettered control over the districting process. So, a lot of people think this is kind of an inside baseball issue. You know, why does this matter, politicians drawing lines? Well, it matters because we all live in districts. Every one of us, we all live in districts. And we live in a lot of different kinds of districts. We live in congressional districts, and state senate districts, and assembly districts, and school districts. And all of those districts have to be drawn. Somebody needs to construct the boundaries of that district. And every line that's put on a map, there's a story behind it. There are implications about what kind of representation the people who are inside of that line are going to receive, and implications for what the people who are outside of that line in other districts are going to receive. So that's why we should care, because this is, it kind of speaks to some of the fundamental questions of why we actually do have a democracy. In terms of gerrymandering is kind of a catch-all term for when district lines are manipulated for some type of gain. And there are some people who would say that any district plan is going to be a gerrymander because someone is choosing who goes into the district and who goes out of the district. The major types of gerrymandering that we talk about are partisan gerrymandering, which is essentially where one party kind of tries to get as many of the seats and push the members of the other party into as few seats as possible. We can talk about racial gerrymandering, where the plan could advantage one particular ethnic or racial group over another. One of the most common, and for me, the kind of the most pernicious forms of gerrymandering is what we call incumbency gerrymandering, which is essentially when the parties kind of collude and say, okay, well, we want to keep things the way they are. We like the amount of seats we have in the state, and so let's just keep things the way they've been for the past decade. And that kind of happens all too often. There is another form of gerrymandering, which a scholar from UC Irvine named Bernie Groffman taught me about as we were researching the film. It's called the dummy mander, which happens sometimes. Essentially, the dummy mander is when a party who controls all levers of the redistricting process gets a little greedy, and they draw a plan in which, essentially they take too many seats and they cut the margins too thin, and then a wave election comes along, and all of a sudden the plan that was drawn to benefit, say, the Republicans, all of a sudden produces more Democrats in Congress or legislatures. This happened in Georgia in the 2000s, Pennsylvania as well. So those are kind of the basics and sort of the starting point for the film. We actually did some animations in the movie that you can see, which explain all this a lot better than I do with music as well. But we're going to show a couple clips from the film right now that just kind of that break it down into some sort of specific kinds of instances and case studies about what happens in the redistricting process. And the first one that we're going to show actually happened in my district in Brooklyn, which is Assembly District 57. And this is the story about what happened to my current assemblyman, Hakeem Jeffries, when he first ran for office in 2000.
I think gerrymandering really works at its worst when individual legislators decide to draw their competition directly out of their district. They target individuals, and they literally box them out so that they can't possibly beat you in the next election.
You know, I used to live on this block.
Oh, really?
In 2002, but the lines were redrawn, most people believe, get me out of the 57th Assembly District.
I'm laughing, yeah. But no, because, they've been doing this for a year.
Right.
I mean, it's been a tradition.
Oh, that's what happened.
This is a different district.
Yeah.
Just right here.
Well, if you walk back down the
I was elected to the New York State Assembly in November of 2006. Prior to that, I had challenged the incumbent of 20 plus years in both 2000 and 2002. The incumbent, Roger Green, was a long-time insider in the Brooklyn Democratic machine. I had no prior political experience, no name recognition, no money in the bank. Probably only two people in the district whose support I could count on, myself and my wife's. But at the end of the day, we had secured over 40% of the vote and shocked the Brooklyn Democratic political machine as well as the establishment.
Hakeem figured he would run again in 2002. What he forgot was that intervening was redistricting. And the map that was drawn was absolutely fascinating. They drew a map that literally carved out the block on which Hakeem Jeffries lived from Assembly District 57.
I remember shaking my head in disbelief. There were a lot of people hoping to vote for me, but were surprised to find that they no longer lived in the Assembly District that they had been living in for years, if not decades. Brooklyn politics can be pretty rough, but that move was gangster.
Some people think that representing these districts is a birthright, but you know, this is a democracy. It's not a dictatorship. It's not a monarchy.
You know, I believe that I work for the people. They give you a 2-year contract, and every year that contract is subject to renewal. They can decide to fire you, or they can decide to rehire you. And one of the big problems with the way in which political lines are redrawn is that you really take away from the public that evaluation process by preventing competitive elections.
So one of the funny things about the way that district changed, if not for that redistricting, I would not live in Hakeem's district, because I always lived, I don't know how well folks know Brooklyn, but I live on the west side of Flatbush, which has never been traditionally part of that district. And so when they cut out Hakeem's block, a couple of districts to the west of on the east of Flatbush, a couple of districts to the west had to be put into the district, and one of them happened to be mine. The people who live across the street from me, across 6th Avenue, live in the other district. So our second clip. This kind of furthers the example that we just talked about. And what happened to Hakeem happens all of the time, all over the country. It's very common for incumbents to cut primary challengers out of their districts. Sometimes they'll cut out all their primary challengers, and they'll also cut out all their general election challengers, as we'll see in this example, which also involves a politician you might know by the name of Barack Obama.
Every state assemblyman believes he or she is going to be a state senator and soon will be in Congress and then will be senator and then will be president. It's inevitable for each and every one of them. So we have thousands and thousands of future presidents running around. Barack Obama is quite fascinating in this regard. He first runs for Congress from a solidly black neighborhood and gets defeated, gets walloped by a black incumbent.
So in 2000, if you're voting for Congress and you live two blocks away from the Obamas, you can vote for then State Senator Obama if you wish. Come 2002, you can no longer vote for Obama. Barack Obama has been removed from the district.
Obama then does something very interesting. His backers, the people who think that he has a future, redistrict his seat in a way that gives him a heavily white liberal constituency.
One day in the spring of 2001, he sat down at a computer with sophisticated mapping software and began the process of redrawing his own district. And that redistricting really was a huge turning point in Obama's political career.
District in 2000 ran across the South Side. In 2002 now, he's got a very tasty chunk of lakefront running from the south all the way up through downtown to an area known as the Gold Coast. And it's a particularly nice district if you plan to run for further office.
Without that redistricting, he may not have been a real contender in that U.S. Senate race.
This is a classic case of inside baseball. Once people know how the game is played, they think it's rigged.
But this is what happens when the politicians themselves are designing their districts. They decide what districts they would like.
That's not really democracy, that's coronation.
So we included Barack Obama in the film not because we felt that what he did was necessarily any worse than what anybody else does in redistricting across the country, but it just goes to show that there can be really extreme consequences to a tweak of the lines, and having the politicians being able to draw that. One of my favorite redistricting stories is about how in the 1700s, after we just established a constitution and became a nation and we were putting together our first Congress, a guy by the name of Patrick Henry was drawing districts in Virginia, and there was an aspiring congressman by the name of James Madison who was trying to run for that first Congress, and Patrick Henry drew James Madison's house out of a district because they didn't like each other very much. And Thomas Jefferson had to come down and intervene to make sure that that James Madison could indeed get elected to that first Congress. And so you kind of think about what would have happened had James Madison never been elected to Congress. Would he become president? What would our country look like? And that's, you know, these are the implications of district lines. So this next clip is kind of a classic partisan gerrymander. I think people probably remember in 2003 when a bunch of Texas legislators fled the state to stop a redistricting plan led by Tom DeLay, which was the second redistricting of the state. And so we followed their steps and went to Ardmore, Oklahoma to see what we could find there about the redistricting.
53 members of the legislature that are acting like children, taking their ball and going home.
But they didn't go home, they ran for the border, a hotel just over the Oklahoma border.
Members were panicked to get across the state lines by midnight.
Undermining our system of democracy.
Unequivocally, overtly political.
Ain't no way.
Important issues are now. Democrats need to live up to their responsibility.
Guys and girls who were scared that they were going to get their ass caught.
It simply requires that they
represent the voters of the state of Texas.
My Democrat friends, it's time to come back to work.
Ardmore was a place where nobody was going to be accused of going there for joy, not to say anything bad about Ardmore, but they don't have a casino there, and they don't have a lot of bars there, and they didn't have the distractions that people might claim, you know, why are you there?
So the Republicans wasted no time in dispatching Texas Rangers to the scene of the crime.
The Texas Department of Public Safety, if probably have arrived or should be arriving at that hotel right now.
Texas State Police did go to Ardmore and invited them to come back to Austin. At that point, Oklahoma State Police are summoned. They determined that Texas Police are out of their jurisdiction. That was the end of the first day where the Democrats finally realized, shit, we may have actually pulled this off.
So we got in the habit of calling roll.
They would have these long tables and they would sit and have their pseudo-capital discussions. The key topic was redistricting and when the Democrats were coming back and did they abdicate, and no, we didn't. We're defending democracy, lowercase. So it went on and on for a number of days, but relatively quickly it settled into a situation where basically Democrats, don't step on yourselves while you're in Ardmore, stay out of the limelight, act like we're carrying on business, when in fact they were not carrying on business.
I know Willie Nelson sent a case of Jack Daniels, I believe. Yeah, a case of it. Then there were also other liquors arrived as presents and gifts from it. But I remember the one from Willie Nelson because it was a case. We went, okay, well, I guess we're going to have some social time. No.
What a bunch of baby heads. You know, they're just arguing about, well, just arguing about their power, which is a big thing to them. But what does this have to do with the people of the state and addressing the problems that we're all facing?
Grassroots moms and dads and families and stayed all night to testify, don't do redistricting, don't do redistricting. The legislature went ahead and did it anyway.
People were just outraged about it.
I had a student who wrote a paper for me, and she began the paper, said, historically there are many reasons why middle-aged men might sneak into a motel late at night. Until now, redistricting has not been one of them.
These doors behind me, these five, one, two, three, four, five, these sets of doors right here, were occupied by the WD-40s, white Democrats, mostly rural, over the age of 40. In the evenings, these rural East Texas good old boys are sitting out there on their chairs, picking and grinning on their guitars, and they're fairly decent guitar players.
They were, on the one hand, loving the hell out of it, giving interviews at the drop of a hat to anybody who would show up, and wondering what's the next step, because the next step entailed
at some point coming home and facing trying times. And some of those guys got their trying times.
Six Democrats were defeated, and we lost 148 years of seniority in one day when that election took place.
Texas always had a tradition of protecting the incumbents. People might not like that, but we recognize that having influential leadership people in both parties is important for Texas at the national level.
I had a district that was significantly minority. I had a significant black population, a significant Hispanic population, and basically what DeLay and his friends did was to chop my district up into five pieces, and so that the Hispanics and the blacks that I previously represented were put into Republican districts, so they lost their voice in Congress.
What happened in Texas was to draw international attention, and the effect of the international attention was to focus on Tom DeLay and his strategy and his policies, and ultimately, I think, lead to his withdrawing from Congress. As to the redistricting itself, it was the best I have ever seen. The fact that they had the opportunity just to draw districts with one objective in mind, defeat Democrats, produced a plan that was outstanding in its gerrymandering.
That's just a quick overview of Texas. That whole fight actually went on for much longer, because after the legislators came back, the state senators, 11 of them, went to Albuquerque and hid in a hotel for 40 days to try and stop the plan after the governor called another special session. So in a lot of ways, you know, what actually happened in the plan itself is not that unique. It was a pretty extreme partisan gerrymander, but these kinds of things happen. But the process by which it went through was kind of unprecedented. That's the one scary part. It's kind of like a heist movie for us. And then the last thing we're going to show, this is just another kind of quirk in the redistricting system about prisons and how we deal with prisons in relation to gerrymandering.
We're in Anamosa, Iowa, where a man got two votes and won a city council seat. He wasn't a candidate. He didn't vote for himself. He went to work one day, and his wife and his neighbor voted him into office.
Well, the mayor called me first, just asked me if I would be willing that I had two votes.
The census counted about 5,500 people here in Anamosa, so that means about 1,374 people per district. In that election, nobody was on the ballot as a candidate. Three write-in votes were cast, but one was for a candidate who didn't live in the district. The other two votes went to Danny Young.
I said, well, I'd give it a try.
Problem in this election wasn't voter apathy. It was a lack of voters. The district includes Anamosa State Penitentiary. Prisoners can't vote, but the U.S. Census counts them where they're locked up. There were 1,321 prisoners counted here, so 96% of this district wasn't allowed to vote. Each of the city's other council districts had 25 times as many real residents as this one. So in effect, if you live next to this prison, you have 25 times as much influence.
Having one person represent 58 people and another person represent 1,500, 1,300, you're not getting equal representation.
Also, it means a very limited pool of potential candidates to serve on our city council.
If you're a legislator, you want a prison in your district. Perfect district from the perspective of an elected official would be your house and a large prison, because as long as your spouse is willing to vote for you, you're guaranteed re-election. The question of prison-based gerrymandering is a new question. Some people didn't notice that prisoners are counted in the census, or they didn't question what could be done about the problem. There's seven New York State Senate districts that would not meet minimum population requirements without using the prisoners as padding. Districts are supposed to be based on population, but when prison populations are used to pad certain legislative districts at the expense of everybody else, we have a situation of representation without population. If the Census Bureau counted people in prison at home, this problem would be over.
And we've actually just fixed prison gerrymandering here in New York. So some legislation has passed and was signed by the governor that I think it will have all the prisoners be counted where they were incarcerated from as opposed to where they are incarcerated, which I think is a great step. So that's all I've got.
Thank you, Jeff.
I'm now just going to welcome our panel. So could we get Michael Wallman, the executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice, to come join us? Tom Sions, the president of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Hi, Tom. And Debo Adegbile, the director, counsel, and the director of litigation for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. U.S. Programs' great executive director, Ann Beeson, will moderate the discussion. Thank you.
Wow, what a great way to start the conversation. Thank you, Jeff, for making this film and for explaining in very plain English, which I is always at a minimum when you have too many lawyers sitting at a table, what this issue is all about. So thank you, Jeff. So I think we're going to just jump right into the conversation. I wanted to just start it off by asking each of the panelists a kind of very open-ended, big-picture question. If you could just make your opening remarks kind of brief. What are some of the specific challenges and opportunities that the coming redistricting cycle presents? So, Michael, why don't you start?
Well, first of all, thank you to OSI. Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Lale, and everybody at OSI and our panelists. This is, of all the issues that all of us work on in the democracy field, campaign finance, voting, independent judiciary, the one that we know will arise every 10 years and pose deep, deep challenges to our meaningful democracy is redistricting. Mm-hmm. That's unique to this country, as you've heard, and it is especially challenging because the issues are so technical, so complex, and because insiders, in many respects, of both political parties have mutual joint interests in making sure nobody else kind of learns too much about what's going on. It's also complex because the goals are as diverse and varied as our pluralist democracy. Now, we should be realistic that in many respects, these issues have been with us since the beginning of the country. In the very first congressional election, Patrick Henry tried to gerrymander James Madison out of his district to keep him from being elected to Congress. These issues have been with us, but they've gotten worse. And one of the challenges that we face in this election and in this redistricting cycle is the professionalization of gerrymandering. In the past, it was often the case that some political genius might be part of one party or another and would be able to do their magic in a way that people didn't understand. Phil Burton, who was the great liberal congressman from San Francisco, when he redrew the political map in California, he sat legendarily in the back room at a restaurant in Sacramento and drew it on the tablecloth. And the California map was called his contribution to modern art. Now, with computerization, with easily available census tract information for everybody, as you heard, even State Senator Obama hired a consultant, and the ability of political parties, of insiders, to redraw the lines for either their own partisan benefit or for the benefit of both parties is new and unparalleled, and that poses new challenges for citizens. You'll hear from some of the other panelists that there are also obstacles to doing much about it because the Supreme Court, especially the current Supreme Court, has taken away a lot of the ability that we all think ought to be there to challenge gerrymandering and redistricting that is unfair, that is racially motivated, that dilutes the power and voice of minority voters. So what are the challenges going forward? The first major challenge we see is public, not apathy, but ignorance. This is coming, it's coming fast, but people don't seem yet aware of it, and it's going to happen right after the election. So for all of us who care about it, there's an urgent need to provide tools, education of the media, and make this something that at least rises to the level of a public issue that people can get mad about. The second challenge is finding a way in to hold elected officials accountable. There is, at the very least, a a goal that we all should share of pulling this out from behind the closed doors, pulling it out from the back room, and insisting on transparency. A lot of the kind of structural reforms that might or might not make sense, such as, say, independent redistricting commissions, some of which can be good, they're too late to do. So we really need to insist on transparency. And the third goal, really, is to involve, to challenge the communities themselves to be involved, to say that what we really care about, at least in the work we do, is not so much the specific outcome of the redistricting, but making sure that real communities, recognizable communities, are represented in the process and represented in the resulting lines. So more than anything else, the great challenge we see is one of prying open those doors and bringing the transformative sunlight of public awareness, and use some of our own computers and some of our own blogs and other things to try to push the process back.
Great. Thanks, Michael. Debo, you want to weigh in?
Sure. The way I like to look at redistricting is to consider what voting is. Voting is about power, and redistricting is about the distribution of power. Who draws the lines has a lot to do with how power is shared and how resources are shared. Our perspective at the Legal Defense Fund is from that of protecting minority voters and African American voters in particular. And the long-established pattern has been that folks have used the line-drawing opportunity to disadvantage concentrations of minority populations. Now, you've probably heard a lot about racial gerrymanders and gerrymanders that are designed to advantage minority communities, and there's been a lot of litigation on these issues in recent years. But if we look back in history, the overwhelming evidence is to the contrary, that the lines are used to disadvantage minority communities and not advantage them. Mm-hmm. We begin from the proposition that districting lines in our system are drawn around communities where they exist, and our societies are denoted by a great deal of residential segregation. That segregation is the result of historical patterns, redlining, all sorts of measures. And so the idea is not, are there going to be minority communities? There are going to be minority communities. We know that in the places where we live. We certainly know that in this city. The question in the redistricting context is, are those communities that live together going to have seats at the table in the halls of power? And so the Voting Rights Act is a very vital tool to try and push back some of the greatest excesses of disadvantaging minority communities. And it has been a very contested act in the history of the United States. The Supreme Court has there are now case books about cases involving the Voting Rights Act and challenges to the Voting Rights Act. It's an act that has been one of the most important in the history of the country, perhaps the most effective civil rights measure ever passed, but also one of the most contested. And I think the reason for that, even 45 years on, and this is the 45th anniversary of the act, is back to the place that I began, because voting is about power and an act that sort of establishes some outer boundaries about how folks can use that power to disadvantage communities is something that's going to be tested. So I'll pause there for now, and hopefully we'll come back to some of these issues as we get into the Q&A. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, I would say that from the perspective of the Latino community, the challenges and opportunities in this next round of redistricting are many. The Latino community nationwide is a growing, rapidly growing community. The census will confirm that. It's a dispersing community, so it's now represented in significant numbers in parts of the country that 10, 15, 20 years ago didn't have significant Latino populations. And that presents both opportunities as well as challenges. Purely from the perspective of congressional redistricting, I would say that there is an opportunity to have at least a half a dozen more Latino majority congressional districts created across the country. Now, that's if the redistricting process goes the way that it should. And there are clearly protections on what anyone who's engaged in redistricting, whether that's an independent commission or a legislature, can do. One of the most important controls is the Voting Rights Act and its prohibition on diluting the voting strength and abilities of minority communities. Unfortunately, the Voting Rights Act is not easily implemented. It's not a set of rules that you can easily follow, and so it ends up being a matter of great contention. And for the Latino community, it means different kinds of challenges in different places. Just a few examples, again, from the perspective of congressional redistricting. Obviously, the Latino community is large and growing in Texas. Texas is projected to gain 3 or 4 congressional seats. Now, if you look at, over the course of the last decade, what has been the growth of population in Texas, 2 or 3 of those new congressional seats ought to be Latino-majority districts. But as you saw in the clip, in Texas, redistricting, particularly at the congressional level, is viewed as highly partisan and tied into national schemes of how to gain advantage in assuring control one party or the other in Congress over the long term. And when you saw the change in 2003, where it was a larger number of Democratic districts, it went down to a smaller number of Democratic districts. What you didn't see is that basically the only Democratic districts that survived in Texas are majority-minority districts. They're either Latino-majority districts or African-American-majority districts. And that's because in Texas, partisanship and race correspond much more closely than they do in other parts of the country. As a result, really, these issues of Voting Rights Act and minority voting rights become very much embroiled in partisan battle over how the district should be drawn. So we can't expect, at MALDEF, representing the Latino community, that it's going to be easy to convince the state of Texas to ensure that a majority of those new districts become Latino-majority districts. Then you have a state like Nevada. It's going to gain at least one congressional district. And it has never had a Latino-majority congressional seat. But based on the numbers, that new district should be a Latino-majority seat. But historically, the first ever to be created is always the most difficult, right? You have entrenched political powers that don't really want to give up their opportunities, whether it's a seat that they already hold or one that they covet, whether they're in the state legislature and always viewed that next congressional district as being theirs. It creates problems, and so we expect a challenge there. And then in a state like California, which is projected to remain even, but the problem is there the population is shifted so that there are districts that are currently not Latino-majority seats that should be Latino-majority seats, and in fact, some of them over the course of the last decade have naturally demographically grown into becoming Latino-majority seats. But that doesn't mean that the incumbents in those seats are going to easily give up their seats or give up their easy advantage in being reelected. So I'll give you an example from 10 years ago, a litigation that I was directly involved in. There was a seat in California that over the course of the previous decade had become a Latino-majority seat. It was held by an incumbent Democrat. Now, that incumbent Democrat probably could have been elected as long as he wanted in a Latino-majority seat because he had that kind of a voting record and that kind of support in the community. But it's also true that if his district remained a Latino-majority seat, he would probably face a primary challenge by a Latino candidate who I believe would fail, but it would nonetheless require resources devoted to a primary that theretofore that incumbent never really had to invest. Now, how did it work out? Well, that particular incumbent, and I won't say his name because I think he's come around to understand that there needs to be a Latino-majority district in the area that he represents, but his brother was the retained map drawer for the state legislature. His brother charged $15,000 to each Democratic incumbent to protect their interests in the process of redistricting.
It's good work if you can get it.
It's very good work if you can get it. There were more or less acknowledged but only discussed openly behind closed doors ceiling thresholds for incumbents where your Latino percentage was not to go above a certain proportion so that you wouldn't face this exact problem of the prospect of a primary challenge. Mm-hmm. And there was public testimony by a leader of the state legislature who basically said, what we're going to do with this district and the neighboring district is split the Latino community. And we're going to split the Latino community so that both of those incumbent Congress members can learn to represent the Latino community. Mm-hmm. So it was basically intentional discrimination with a smiling face, right? It was all about teaching these incumbent Congress members how to represent the Latino community. Still intentional discrimination. Nonetheless, our legal challenge failed for reasons that I could go into but are not really worth going into at this point. But it's an indication of even where there is, it's not partisan like it is in Texas, it's not creating the first district, there are still strong interests arrayed against the kind of opportunity that the Latino community through its demographic growth and dispersion has earned. So that's the great challenge that we face in this 2011 round of redistricting.
So let's pick up, Tom, you gave a couple of examples of this, but let's get into a little more detail about where the action is in this cycle. Where are the other places where other states that are likely to gain or lose seats, and you know, how what are your guesses as to how that's going to impact map drawing in those states? So anybody that wants to jump in?
I think the Southwest is going to be the area of biggest growth. I have some numbers here that Arizona is going to pick up one. Florida, which is south, not west, is going to pick up two. These are projections. Georgia is expected to pick up one. Nevada will pick up one. South Carolina, one. Texas, four. Utah, one. And Washington, one. Mm-hmm. Louisiana is expected to lose. Those are some numbers that that we have. I'm sure there are additional projections. People spend a lot of time and energy on this, and so the bean counting has already begun. But there is sort of a concentrated part of the country where you hear about lots of that growth, and it speaks to Tom's issue about what's driving that growth and which minority populations are driving the growth numbers. And there's something embedded in the discussion that Tom shared with us, which is some of the greatest opportunity for shenanigans is where there are new demands on power by growing groups. That's where the rubber meets the road, where the entrenched powers are trying to stave off efforts to organize in growing communities. And so very often when you hear about the Voting Rights Act that tries to police the boundaries, people like to look back and say, well, it's not 1965, nobody's being beaten, there are no more rubber hoses, you know, vote denial isn't what it used to be. But the fact is, politics is a contact sport. And in redistricting, it is scary. We were told it wasn't scary earlier, I think, when you see some of it and when you've been in some of these litigations and you meet the masters of the map. It can be a bit of a scary process. So that's one of the things that is running through these debates. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, it's democracy, but it's bare-knuckle democracy. Mm-hmm.
And Tom, of course, said a little bit about the implications for the Latino community. Do you want to say a word or two, Debo, about the implications for some of these shifts on the African-American community?
Sure. Well, I'll start with Louisiana, the expected loss of population. I guess there are kind of two stories in Louisiana. Obviously, we had the natural disasters in Louisiana and then the man-made disasters that made the natural disaster worse. And we think about the hurricane, but I guess the levee breach is what was the thing that really undid the city of New Orleans. And so there was great population dispersal of a historic African-American community. The community has not been fully restored. All of the people are not back. Some folks have resituated in different parts of the state. So I think it's happening on two levels in Louisiana. There will be some redistribution of centers of population that will affect politics on the ground. But I think the expectation still is that there probably will be a net loss. There's some expectation that maybe it won't be terrible. But if I were to wager, I would expect that there would be some net loss there. So in that community, there's going to be some internal politics and a bit of a national difference. In some of the other communities and some of the other states, there are going to be both. I said that there are going to be sort of challenges between entrenched powers and new demands for seats at the table. And many of those will be between white incumbents and Latino communities. Some of those may well be between African-American incumbents and Latino communities. And so in a number of places, there are groups of advocates who have gotten together to discuss ways in which redistricting doesn't need to be absolutely zero-sum. And there can be some collaborative approaches so that there is not a situation where everybody's shooting at each other and at the end of the day minority communities lose in the process. Some of those efforts have been successful. There's one in New York that we've been engaged in. I'm looking around the room and I see some of my colleagues here, Margaret Fong of the Asian American Legal Defense Fund, Angelo Falcon, a whole bunch of folks are here. And we have a New York Voting Rights Consortium. And we get together to sort of talk about the numbers in advance of redistricting to sort of think about things and have public education and talk to communities about solutions that can be win-win. Not all of the minority electeds are elected from majority-minority districts that are entirely Latino or entirely African-American. There are people who are elected from coalition districts or, in the case that Tom described in California, a Latino district or a high concentration of Latinos that will elect a white incumbent. And so there are different possibilities in the mix. The reason, however, that we speak in terms of minority-majority districts so often is that in many places there is what we call racially polarized voting patterns, and that is where white voters will exercise, in effect, a veto over a minority elected if there's a biracial contest, a white candidate running against an African-American or Latino candidate. And if the level of racially polarized voting is very high, the only way that the minority community can overcome that practice is to have a majority of the voters in the district. And so it's in that context that many minority advocates look to minority-majority districts to give an opportunity to have seats at the table because of a pattern of exercising a veto over qualified minority candidates who have run for office. So that's the underlying dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Michael, can you say a few words about how the November elections are going to impact all of this? And Jeff, feel free to jump in too, I'm sure. Mm-hmm.
Overlaid over what we've just heard about is both the kind of politics that happens in a state where it isn't an expanding pie or a rising ethnic population, say the Latino population in the Southwest, but a shrinking pie. New York is expected to lose 1 to 2 seats. Ohio, the normal exodus from the northeastern industrial states continues. And so there the politics, for starters, regardless of what the electoral outcome is in a few weeks, will be brass knuckles, will be polite if that's all that happens, because you have parties and even incumbents from the same party fighting over a declining number of seats. But it is absolutely the case that on top of all this will be whatever the electoral shifts are in a few weeks. And for people who are, for example, perturbed by the trend of the electorate right now, they couldn't be coming at a more consequential time. Mm-hmm. Whoever the governor is, whoever controls the state legislatures in these states, in almost all the states, will have a disproportionate say over the drawing of the legislative districts. What you saw, for example, in Texas mm-hmm. was a retaliation, some would say, for what had happened in Georgia, where the Democrats controlled the governorship and much of the legislature and were able to draw lines at the beginning of the decade that greatly favored the Democrats in terms of legislative redistricting, even when a Democratic incumbent governor and a Democratic incumbent senator in Georgia lost, but Democrats gained congressional seats in the 2002 election. Mm-hmm. So we will know very soon, the day after the election, what the consequence of that is going to be. And it could tilt. You could see a situation where, assuming that a lot of the projections are what they are, that you're going to see Republican electoral maps locked into place for a decade in a way that had not been the case in the previous decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You asked what are some of the other challenges, and it relates to this issue specifically, because another challenge, as Debo talked about, where there's expansion and there's a growing Latino community, is Arizona. So who here would like to help us to ensure that Latino voting rights are protected by a legislature that passed SB 1070 and a governor who's going to get elected, who signed it and used it as a vehicle to get elected governor? That's the kind of challenge that you've got, where really the demographics indicate that there should be some opportunity for the Latino community, but because of the likely outcome of the November election, it's going to be extraordinarily daunting. You add to that what's going on in Arizona actually further contributes to the racially polarized voting that Debo talked about. I mean, the way that state has been split along ethnic racial lines really means that I would expect in this November election some of the most stark racially polarized voting data that we've seen in quite some time. Mm-hmm. And to just give a flavor of how serious that issue remains, I talked about the case that we brought in California 10 years ago. Part of the reason that we lost that case was that the three judges who were hearing the case were impressed by the fact, I kid you not, that on some rare occasions, up to one-third of white voters would actually vote for a Latino candidate. In rare occasions, up to one-third. And that was viewed as extraordinarily progressive. So that just gives you a context of how serious, if not necessarily well-known, other than when we go through this once-every-decade process of redistricting, the phenomenon of racially polarized voting really is across the country.
Jeff, you want to weigh in?
I guess you know what interests me about this round is the actual potentials for having better processes, and not just via. There are a couple of big ticket reform items on ballots in Florida and California that we'll probably get to talk about later. But as we were researching the film, we started talking to GIS folks, and they feel like they're on the brink of a revolution in terms of how the public can be involved in redistricting. You know, how it's worked in the past is there have been hearings, and some people show up to hearings, and most people don't really know what redistricting is. And in a lot of cases, the hearings were done just because they were mandated. They weren't serious hearings. They weren't there to really address needs of communities. But now that we have things like something as banal as Google Maps, where which I think personally has kind of reshaped the way we think about our communities, because now we can look at them from the top down and see what the houses look like and what goes where. and if you couple that with very available open source mapping software, all of a sudden a process that back in the 1970s was done on adding machines and million-dollar computers, we can do it all on our laptops. And so I like the potential for people to be drawing their own maps, participating in the process that way. And Ohio even did a kind of a test run for a model that I like. They held a competition. I think it was last year in 2009. They held a competition. They listed some criteria. And they just opened it up, and they picked plans that they liked based on that criteria. And in a lot of cases, the plans that were submitted were better on all of the counts of things that we like in redistricting, compactness, protection of minority rights, competition, things like that. They were better than the plans that the legislature said they could produce. I think the winning plan was actually produced by a state senator from Illinois, which I think is kind of interesting. But the potential for a civically minded high school student to sit in their bedroom and draw a really good redistricting plan and show it to the legislature and say, well, I actually did better. I think it's there. It's just a matter of kind of marshaling the awareness and getting people involved.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're pro-technology. So we've got to vote for the technology and a little bit of concern about what can be done with it. Already another theme that's surfaced, although maybe we need to surface it a little more explicitly, is that there are different values that that play out in this conversation, right? And one of them is more about fairness and competition, et cetera, and another one is about ensuring minority voting rights. And I wonder if you all can say a little bit more about the tensions between those two points of view and where perhaps the middle ground can be found. Yeah, I don't know who wants to jump in, but.
Well, I would define attention in slightly differently. I think that it really is attention between communities of interest and concentrating communities of interest in single districts. And in some cases, those communities of interest are defined by race or ethnicity. Historically, that's a lot of what the definition of community interest might be, in part because so many other attributes that define a community of interest, which is in the eye of the beholder, but whether that's socioeconomic or educational or whatever other demographic characteristic might define a community of interest, often overlap with race or ethnicity. So the tension is really between creating districts that concentrate similar communities of interest versus highly competitive districts. Because if you have districts that concentrate similar communities of interest, those districts are not going to tend to be highly competitive. I mean, if you could figure out which kinds of communities of interest are going to end up trending toward the Democrats, and you can figure out which kinds of communities of interest are going to end up trending toward the Republicans, and so they don't necessarily lend to highly competitive districts. So that really is the challenge, and I think it's a deeper philosophical debate that in some ways hasn't really been fully played out and really played out at a level that would allow some very well-informed policy decisions to be made, because they're often presented not as necessarily oppositional, but, oh, we need more competition in California, therefore we need a different process to do this, or generally we need to protect minority voting rights, and that's not necessarily in conflict, but really as a subset of communities of interest, it is in conflict. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's been the kind of debate, and it's also hamstrung by the fact that, unfortunately, this is a process we only go through every 10 years, barring Texas, which chose to do it twice last decade for reasons that we could explain, but Usually, jurisdictions only go through this once every 10 years, so it doesn't really attract anybody's attention except once a decade. And over the course of a decade, the people who are interested, a lot of them have gone on to other things or no longer interested or don't remember the expertise that they acquired 10 years earlier. So there isn't really the kind of ongoing debate about the tension that you've identified and, mm-hmm. and how it should really best to be reconciled with what we're trying to do with redistricting, which is at bottom simply trying to come up with districts that are reasonably compact, that make sense, however that means, and that equalize populations among districts, because that's ultimately where you have to end up, because you can't have districts that have much larger population than others simply because over the course of a decade people have moved mm-hmm. in a part of a state or in a part of the country.
Michael? I think Tom has absolutely correctly identified two real sets of values, both of which are important, which have sometimes in the past and now been posed as in conflict, and sometimes they are in conflict. Part of what we've been trying to think through is how to make sure that the inevitable conflict among some of these values doesn't derail the broad common interest that we all should have in a better process and better outcomes. And so, for example, to me and to the Brennan Center, transparency and citizen empowerment is a way of bringing some of these debates to the fore in an open way, and everybody should be, nobody benefits ultimately from a decision that's made in the back room. Nobody benefits from if there's a counterposing potentially between competition on the one hand and minority representation on another. That's not always the case, but in any case, sort of the partisan cartel, as Professor Samuel Zakharoff describes it, which is that both parties make sure that no incumbent ever has an opponent, that's another value altogether. And so in the short run, bringing the public into it, there may be fights down the road, but it will, in any case, it will be a much better process later on. And that also puts a real burden on the good government groups who care about process and competition. The great mistake that has been made far too often is that well-meaning reform proposals have been rushed out, often for things like commissions designed to take the line drawing away from the self-interested legislators, without adequate thought about the impact on minority representation, which is a core value. And it can't be blinked away that it's got to be taken into consideration. And there are far too many efforts that don't take that seriously, and there are far too many reform proposals that don't explicitly protect those rights or explicitly reference the Voting Rights Act in their language. And these are, again, these are mistakes that, if you keep making the same mistake over and over again, you should learn a way not to do it. But again, so it's not that it's a false choice, but it's a postponable choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Obviously, from this conversation, we can see that it is a very complex issue. It is one that tends to come up only every 10 years. The your average person on the street is, blissfully unaware of the impact of these processes. I'm curious, Jeff, to hear a little bit from you about what impact you think the film can have on the debate.
Well, I hope it has a big one. Yeah. We screen the film all over the place, and we've shown now in something like 20 states, and I've been there a lot of times with the film, and people come up afterwards and say, wow, this is, what can I do? Which is really exciting, because I think, it's exciting, but it's also, it speaks to some of the complications of making a movie about redistricting. I feel like a lot of the documentaries I worked on, at the end of the movie, it's very clear what you're supposed to do. After you see Food, Inc., you should stop eating the bad meat. Or after you see Inconvenient Truth, you should get some green light bulbs and retrofit your house for the weather. But in terms of redistricting, well, what can you do? Mm-hmm. Because you can't ever arrive at a perfect product. You're always going to produce plans that some people are going to be unhappy with. Some people are always going to feel like they should be in a different district or feel like they should get a different kind of representation. but I try to tell people that's not something to be afraid of. That's something that's kind of exciting about democracy, is that, it is about this struggle and this conflict of interest and people coming together and arguing and fighting. That's why we have a democracy, so that we can voice these opinions. I think, the problem is, as we've been talking about, is the process by which we arrive at these products is often, it's bogus, it's held behind closed doors, and the public is not really involved in it. There are some reform efforts, as I mentioned earlier. There's the Amendments 5 and 6 in Florida, which, you know, what it does is it essentially sets it puts standards in the Constitution. And some of the policy folks could probably actually explain it better than I can, but they put standards in the Constitution by which the legislature is supposed to follow when they do redistricting. And I think the idea being, because they couldn't create an independent commission there because there was not enough support for it, that at least if there are some standards, it makes the plans easier to sue in court if there are problems with them. I think I'm getting that right? And then there's also Proposition 20 in California, which would extend the independent commission created with Proposition 11. It's something we follow in the film. Prop 11 was a 2008 initiative that creates an independent commission of 14 citizens that would draw the districts for the state legislative districts. Prop 20 would extend the jurisdiction to cover congressional districts. And there's also Prop 27 on the ballot, which would disband the Proposition 11 commission before it even starts. And there are pitfalls with independent commissions, but you know, on the film side, we do support those efforts there because I think you know they're well intentioned, and I'm optimistic about how the process could turn out. One of the things we've allowed to be done is that the Prop 20 folks have sent out something like 660,000 copies of the movie to registered voters. Just all across the state. I don't know how they've been targeting them, but we're getting tons of emails back from people saying, wow, I've actually never even heard of redistricting. And now that I've seen this, I'm interested in the process. You know, can I sign up for the commission? You know, I think I'm going to vote yes on 20.
Isn't there a political story behind that, too? Like, who's pushing 20 and who's pushing 27?
Well, you know, yeah, sure. I mean, in California politics, Republicans tend to push for the independent commission reforms to take it away from the legislature, and Democrats tend to push against that because they are the ones controlling the seats and drawing the districts. And, you know, from our perspective, sure, personally, I want to see more Democrats elected to Congress, but at the same time, I don't want to see them elected to Congress through unfair processes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if we lose a couple seats in California, which I think, you know, even if an independent commission draws the lines, I don't see how Republicans all of a sudden take over the state. I think it's more really, as Tom was talking about earlier, it's more about Democratic incumbents protecting themselves from insurgent minority communities than anything else.
I think both Tom and Michael wanted to jump in. Either way, go ahead.
Well, I just want to echo something that Michael said, because we've talked about this before. I agree that I think transparency and actually some disqualifications are necessary reforms that would help us to have a cleaner process, whether it's done by a legislature or an independent commission, that would then permit us to have the kind of debates that at present we can't really have. I should say that with respect to the Independent Redistricting Commission in California, which I opposed, although now I oppose both the repeal and the expansion of it, because I think we now have this strange situation in California where there's a hybrid process where the legislature is going to do one part, the Redistricting Commission is doing another part, and I think it will be a good exercise for citizens to see the two processes working at the same time and decide which one works better. I think what's missing from both of them is the kind of transparency and disqualification that I would like to see. The danger, I think, with redistricting commissions is that you get citizens, and we don't yet know who's going to be on the redistricting commission in California, and I have high hopes that it will end up being folks who are very, very strong and well-informed and educated. But the danger is that if that's not the commission you end up with, they become captives of the experts that they hire, right? So then it's the map drawers who really end up making decisions. And you'll remember what I described happening 10 years ago in California. It was the map drawer that was the problem. And so that's where I would like to see, whether it's a legislator or a commission that's doing it, some real serious sunshine on what are the kinds of connections that exist between the consultants who are retained and the office holders and potential office holders, as well as some real disqualifications of the kinds of relationships that may or may not exist between those consultants who are retained and the folks who have an undeniable conflict of interest. You also want to see kind of a disclosure of the kind of $15,000 payments that I mentioned previously. They were sort of outside of the ordinary political realm, so it was hard to sort of track. And I think you also want to make sure that nobody, whether it's a legislature or a commission, is able to claim some sort of privilege, because that was the other problem that we faced in California 10 years ago. The state legislature claimed a legislative privilege, which is a recognized privilege in court, which basically means they don't have to testify about what was said behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And so I would hate, for example, to see an independent redistricting commission anywhere be able to claim a similar sort of legislative privilege that would mean that whatever happens behind closed doors doesn't ever get disclosed to the public. So I agree with Michael. I think the first step is really to have some strong transparency and disqualification measures in place that extend not just to the ultimate decision makers, but the experts that they're relying upon to make their decisions.
I should say, before I say what I was going to say, that those are really interesting challenges for journalists and for citizen journalists to really try to unravel some of these connections, which I think, we did a briefing yesterday on voting down in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club, and the reporters there are somewhat punch drunk because of all the campaigning and the money and the voting issues, but we talked about the next wave of redistricting, and they were both interested and not all that educated, and this is a great thing for them to dig into. I was just going to mention that one thing that has been interesting over the years is one of the obstacles to redistricting reform has been the precise sense that it always benefits clearly one party or another wherever it takes place. So in 2006, there was a redistricting reform proposal, a commission proposal in Ohio and in California, and it was backed by the Democrats in Ohio because they thought the Republicans had been hurting them in the way the lines were drawn, and it was backed by the Republicans in California and Governor Schwarzenegger because they thought they'd been hurt. And the voters rejected them in both places by roughly similar margins. And there were a lot of reasons, but it's the old adage to a certain degree of you have to make the dog food that the dogs will actually eat. Part of it was that people felt that the constitution of the way the commissions were set up was elitist and would cut them out of the process. But part of it also was Republicans thought they were going to get hurt in Ohio, and Democrats thought they were going to get hurt in California. So one answer, which is very tough, it's like game theory, is you need to find a way for Republicans and Democrats to move together in various places where there's a chance for change and reform. And so Andrew Cuomo, in his campaign for governor in New York, he supports a commission, and he has said also that he would veto any bill that was bad gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. And what one idea has been to encourage a Democratic governor, should he win, to partner with a Republican governor of another state so that it's not clearly really just for one advantage of one party or another, but that there be a kind of a move across the country toward a better result.
Mm-hmm. I want to open it up for questions, so start thinking of your questions, audience members. And I had hoped we would have time to talk a little bit about prison gerrymandering, which Jeff highlights in the film, and I don't think we have time to sort of talk about it now, but what I did want to point out, actually, because it's an issue that we care a lot about at OSI and have been very proud to support a lot of the efforts to raise awareness about the problem and propose reforms, is that there may be some, it's actually kind of quite unusual, it seems to me, that would be the issue that has actually become talked about a bit in the public and in the press, and that it's the gerrymandering issue that most recently has actually moved, because you think it would be the hardest one of all to kind of fix. And so there may be lessons learned that I would love for you guys to draw on, maybe if we get into a Q&A with the audience around it, from that work that could be applied to some of the broader issues around redistricting and gerrymandering.
Yeah, I mean, hire Peter Wagner to do everything.
Yes, I know. Isn't he fabulous? Peter's the answer to everything, exactly. The Peter Wagner bullet, we'll call it, yeah. So, yeah, come on up to the microphone, if you wouldn't mind, and I do need to say at this point that we are, I'm sure you saw the little red sign up here, recording the event, and so you're consenting to be recorded if you speak into the microphone, and please do speak into the microphone so that we can capture it on tape. So come on up, folks. Looks like we got a lot of interest. Yes.
Hi, how are you? So my question is actually towards the release of new data, more so than the last decade, in terms of ACS demographic data that's not going to...
Ah, there we go.
So Thanks. This has become one of my major... interest right now in terms of the release of citizen voting age population data in December before the release of demographic redistricting data that states use to redistrict. So now we're going to get fresh data that we didn't have prior, probably New Jersey and Virginia would have never seen it during the redistricting cycles, and then New York probably would have never seen it either because it takes about almost 3 years before you can get citizenship voting age population data. Now we're going to see it 3-4 months before the actual redistricting data comes out. So I kind of want to know throughout the decade, a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment. Arizona 1070, obviously many hate crimes, particularly in New York. We saw Brooklyn, major decisions this year in Suffolk, and then you have Pennsylvania going on, and then some major issues in small towns in New Jersey in terms of major hate crimes against immigrants. So I'm wondering how that's going to impact the site, the process, and the use of anti-immigrant sentiment and voting age population data, citizenship voting age population data.
It's a very good question, and it's a very critical question, particularly for the Latino community, because as you've identified, there is a wave of anti-immigrant sentiment across the country, and certainly there are well-heeled political forces that are ready to take every advantage of that. And we've already seen that kind of threat. I mean, to some extent, it's already in our established jurisprudence. I mean, in order to establish that you have a right to have a majority-minority district, you've got to show that the minority group has the ability to control an outcome. And so that basically means that you're looking at CVAP data to see if there are enough citizens voting age so that that the Latino community in this case could actually control the outcome in a district. So that's already part of the jurisprudence. What's a greater threat, particularly with questions about reliability of data that I know Angelo wants to talk about, and I want to talk about with him, but with questions about reliability of data on CVAP, the bigger danger is there is going to be a movement, and we've already seen indications of it, to basically say that states should draw districts based on CVAP data, all districts. And what that means is that you would have some districts that have much, much higher populations because they are non-citizen populations than other districts. Now, I believe that that's unconstitutional, certainly at the congressional level, and likely even at state legislative and local levels. But it's certainly an issue that the other side is very interested in contesting. And that's a very serious danger, because you then end up with districts that are oversized. And they're entirely oversized because they are largely immigrant, non-citizen districts. And that's a very serious threat to democracy, in my view. But it's not like we haven't seen that kind of threat to democracy from the forces that are trying to take advantage of this anti-immigrant sentiment in so many other ways as well.
Thank you. The next question?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. That's smart.
Two brief questions. The first is concerning public participation in redistricting. And in New York City, even beginning in 1991, we made a terminal available to the public to come in and craft redistricting plans, either partial or whole. And as the technology of redistricting has changed, as you say, the ability of lots of people to draw lines has expanded greatly. But you can't really draw a one-district or a two-district plan. And the whole sort of public participation is something that, you know, it requires a lot of expertise about demographics and about the law and what constitutes an acceptable plan and balancing the interests and so forth. And that's not something that's easily accomplished by a group coming to a place to pick apart one part of a plan. So the first question is, how do you get citizen participation to craft a whole plan that stands up and, you know, makes various trade-offs and stands up to the various requirements, as opposed to just reacting to and critiquing to one part of a plan that somebody else is writing? And the other question is, within many urban settings, New York, LA, and so forth, there are growing groups that may have been relatively recent arrivals. In the past, not high levels of citizenship, but that aren't represented by the groups that have traditionally stood up for minority rights, whether it's the NAACP Legal Defense Fund or Asian American Legal Defense Fund. For example, to take a New York City example, in Queens, in Ozone Park, there's an emerging South Asian community. It's Indian, Bangladeshi, Guyanese, Indian. It's very diverse. That concentration is divided into four council districts, which were designed in part because of representation of African Americans in Southeast Queens. And so, how does an emerging community, which is not represented by well-established organizations to advocate for its interests, how does a group like that get into the game.
I'll start, but I'm sure I'll need help, because that's a very difficult question. I think that the technology is going to democratize the process some, but I think the issues that you have pointed to suggest that even the technology by itself won't take us all of the way that we need to go, because there is a certain amount of expertise that one needs to have. Redistricting is a system of constrained choice. It's very Rubik's Cube like, for those of you who remember that toy. With these new commissions and in other places, essentially what they're doing is they're taking certain options off the table with their redistricting rules, and so you have to operate under the new set of rules. And the technology allows you, if you understand the data and the requirements, the rough equality of districts, where the communities of interest are, what the natural geographic boundaries are. In some places, there are rules against favoring a party or favoring incumbents. You have to get a community together. It's organizing. It's organizing at bottom, because the technocrats by themselves can't give voice to a community if they are not getting input from the community about what that community of interest is, what the voice is, what the needs are and the desires, who has shared interests, and where, you know, cutting a line makes a big difference. And so I don't think that the technology will relieve us of the obligation to have meetings, to bring people together, to go out and do public education in advance of the redistricting processes, so that people who want to come together and can get involved have the tools. That's my own view, but perhaps there are others.
I would echo that. This is really all about coalition building. It still is. And the danger of the technology being so easily accessible and easily usable is that you get 5,000 maps submitted and then the experts throw up their hands and get to do whatever they want. Yeah. Right? So it's really about making sure that coalitions are working together to put together unity maps. I mean, Debo talked about unity maps. We had unity maps in California 10 years ago, and I think you really still have to strive for that, and you've got to make it as broad a coalition as you can, including smaller groups that maybe haven't been represented in the past and groups that wouldn't even fall within the category of minority voters. You've just got to have as much of a consensus around a map as possible so that you don't inundate them with so many choices that they get completely unconstrained choice.
And I would suggest also that in addition to the imperative for coalition building, community organizing, and grassroots mobilization, decision makers can help that along with the way they solicit input from the community. If there are hearings all over New York State, for example, about Attorney General Cuomo has said he wants in his booklet about all this, where the hearing is will help draw in a community and will help create the community by being in that community, and suddenly people turn up and realize that they have a common set of interests. Mm-hmm. As you look at the notion of what's a real community, in a sense, the folks within the community know themselves, even if they can't articulate it necessarily. And so it's not a clean and neat process, but that is something where, short of the mega macro redistricting reforms, at the very least, public officials can help facilitate that. And that goes, I think, Ann, to what you were saying, which is there's a tendency sometimes in these issues to look for the unified field theory of reform, and after that, you know, Olympian guardians will draw the lines and all will be well. But in the meantime, there are sometimes smaller changes that can have a big impact, such as the prison, the ghost voters in the prisons, and how, you know, there ought to be a meeting in that community.
Let me also mention that there are a couple of resources. LDF, MALDEF, Asian American Justice Center have put together a redistricting guide that lays out some of the criteria, the things to consider. It has a lot of information in there that can be a resource to any community, because it sets out the rules. You can find it on our website, naacpldf.org, or redrawingthelines.org. The Brennan Center also has a redistricting guide. And so begin with these...
one remaining
in hand, in hand. And so these are the building blocks of organizing, bringing the material to folks. Sometimes it's helpful to actually bring people who can demystify the text, because whenever you hear redistricting lawyers or policy people get together, you heard the first question from an old friend of mine. We get to the weeds very quickly, and we can talk to each other in a language nobody else understands. CVAP, BVAP, all sorts of craziness about the data. So you have to break it down and make it accessible to people so that they can understand the core concepts and then build it up from there.
If I could just join in with a little bit of marketing for those of you listening on the podcast, I'm holding up a very nicely designed...
Didn't I do that?
No, I appreciate that. Citizens, this is the Brennan Center, Citizens Guide to Redistricting. There are only 10 copies of this edition left in existence, so you can't have it. But we have a sign-in sheet, and if anybody's interested in getting the next edition, which should be out next month, we would be very happy to get it to you. And our colleague Erica Wood, who leads our redistricting work, can make sure of that.
Great. So
we have hundreds and hundreds of them.
Oh, no.
Call tomorrow. I'll send you a box.
Ours is secret. Yeah. Ours is secret. No one's allowed to know what's in it.
I wonder if the panel can make a connection between redistricting in 2011 and the 2010 elections. And I'm thinking specifically about the extent to which vote suppression tactics play a role in setting the stage for controlling the redistricting process next year. I mean, I have to think that people like Tom DeLay, who are seem to be master chess players, are thinking five steps ahead and maybe thinking about ways to suppress the minority vote and how that might set the stage in terms of who's at the table in the redistricting process a year from now would favor one political party or another. And suppressing the vote through traditional dirty tricks or maybe some newer age ones like anti-immigrant public policies or rhetoric of communication to kind of make the bring redistricting fast forward to November 2nd and your views on that.
So in the last election, there was one that was new to me, perhaps not new to others, but it was new to me. We had to file a case in Indiana to stop a threat to challenge voters whose homes had been foreclosed. Mm-hmm. The idea is that you vote based on your address, and there were partisan threats to threaten voters on election day whose names appeared on foreclosure lists on the theory that they may not be valid voters at that address anymore. And these tactics are especially odious because they need not necessarily be practiced to be effective. That is to say, if you're somebody who's in distress and election day is coming, perhaps these voters should be the first in line to talk about the political climate in the country, right? Certainly they have interests. But if word goes out that you're going to be challenged, people are going to put your economic status or your difficulty in play publicly on election day, whether or not it actually happens, it can have a serious chilling effect on voters coming to the polls. Now, this was something that happened in 2008 and the injunction issued and the parties agreed not to participate in the shenanigans. So it stopped. But I would look for things like this. Tom spoke about the climate in Arizona. There are going to be tricks out there because there are every election season. Whether or not they are dispositive in critical races is the open question. But I will say the people who like to employ these tricks pick the places where they're going to matter most, right? They don't invest the time and energy in a place where it's going to be a runaway election. It's the place where the rubber meets the road that these tactics are employed, and if they are used on a wide scale and not pushed back, of course it could affect the outcome of an election and then in turn the process that we've been talking about tonight.
And I would just say I would be wary of giving Tom DeLay too much credit. I mean, he's no Karl Rove. I don't know that anybody needs a further incentive to voter suppress because it happens all the time. But I do think that your question points out something very important, which has been sort of below the surface, which is I mentioned previously this happens once a decade, and so people aren't really engaged in it all along. There are two groups that are really engaged in this all the time, and they're thinking about it all the time, and that's the political parties. So if we don't ensure that the communities are well-informed and educated about this process through manuals and the like and engaged, then really you end up leaving it to the two groups that have really been thinking about this for the entire decade, and that's the two political parties, and their interests do not, either one of them, coincide with necessarily the interests of the communities that we care about.
And you do see the parties, interestingly, pouring resources into legislative races that even in congressional districts that don't seem that in play, but they know that the legislative races within those congressional districts can affect the outcome down the road. There is one new factor in vote suppression and voter intimidation. Heretofore, election day challenges and other naked voter intimidation has principally been practiced by candidates and parties. This year, there's some real evidence that the Tea Party and vigilante groups, in effect, that are erupting all over the place, have taken it upon themselves that they are going to try to police the elections and make sure that only eligible citizens get to vote. They don't need to declare that they're going to do this before it happens, but we've accumulated quite a bit of at least anecdotal evidence that there's trouble a-brewing. And again, we're on the lookout, but this is something that only the media and law enforcement, federal, state, and local law enforcement, needs to stand firm against this kind of intimidation.
So we need to end on time in just a few minutes, but why don't we go ahead and take the two final questions, just if we could keep them kind of brief, just in a row, and then we'll hold and you guys can answer both of them at once. Okay?
It's a quick one.
Sure, great.
First, I just want to thank all the panelists. Just to follow up on the question that the gentleman had asked, I'm just curious to know, I mean, I know that you guys, with the exception of the filmmaker, Jeff, I know that you guys spend a significant amount of your time looking at legal issues and legislation, but I'm just curious to know, what amount of time do you spend looking at strategy to hit the average Joe, you know, the average person, since to really, you know, potentially move the needle on redistricting, you really have to get the buy-in of the person who, you know, just to see how it's going to affect their life. So I'm just curious to know, what percentage of your time or what amount of time are you thinking about strategy to hit the average person? And then in terms of the coalition building that you'd spoken about before, and then also working with the media. So I'm just curious to know about what amount of time you're looking at non-legal issues, but to just hit the average voter, citizen. So I'm just curious, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for taking my question. Yeah, I'm very interested in this problem. And I've been curious, though, why legal people are not taking a slightly different angle. And I wonder, I know we're running out of time, but Posner, who works in antitrust in Chicago, has the book Law and Democracy. And he talks about, if we could identify the political parties as corporations, which they are, no longer, you know, collective bodies that are trying to be representative, but in fact are corporations, they could be sued, in all the evidence you've put together, for anti-competitive practice. Because what you're really describing is a business model that constrains competition to drive up the price. Because besides the fact that the people don't get representation of their issues, they can't afford to run. So I was just here thinking, you know, it sounds like they've got us so wrapped up in their lines and their map drawing. Why don't we take it from the top and talk about antitrust? Because we have a good capital model that says you can't have collusion, you can't have restraint of competition. And I wonder if you've thought about that, because then we could have at-large districts, you could have proportional voting, and these things would vanish with all their magic lines.
Mm-hmm. Yes. A good provocative last question. So if I could just ask you guys to answer the final questions, and also I would love to kind of close with a couple of suggestions from each of you about what more the public can do to get engaged. They read the great guides. Okay, what next? Like, what are one or two very specific ways that people can get engaged in these issues in their communities? So whoever wants to start. Jeff, you want to start? Why don't you start at the far end?
Well, in terms of how much time I spend thinking about how to communicate this to the public for the past 5 years, it's been a lot. And I've also done a lot of reading of legislation and things. It's the kinds of stuff that I never thought I'd really get into. but in terms of suggestions that I would make to folks, sure, see the movie, that's helpful. But we're working on our own advocacy tool. It's at a website called endgerrymandering.com, which is maybe a little bit hyperbolically named, but the idea of the site is that it's based on an engine built by these folks in Philadelphia called Redistricting the Nation. And you can go there, and anybody can punch in their address, and see the contours of their district, which I think this is the first time that this has ever been that widely available. And you can actually see the overlay of your congressional district on your state senate district, on your state legislative district, and you can see how what kinds of communities are in the district. And moreover, you can also see who represents the districts now. And the idea would be eventually that you could create tools so that way you can organize around those districts and reach out to your legislators very easily to ask them specifically about the redistricting question. Because I think one of the reasons why legislatures get such a free pass on this is because no one's paying attention when it happens. It only happens 10 years, once every 10 years, as we've said. No one's really paying attention. It comes and goes, and they feel kind of, you know, further emboldened each time the process goes around. They're able to sort of run the table with us. So these are things that could help.
First off, I think Professor Posner's idea is really interesting, and I think Judge Posner would not hear it in court for more than 5 minutes. Unfortunately, I don't think that kind of suit would really stand. But I do think that the broader point is this. We're a think tank and an advocacy group. We don't have a grassroots component. We work with those folks who do have grassroots components to train them, to educate them in how to talk about this. But part of what we all need to do is to see this not in isolation. It isn't only redistricting and gerrymandering that insulates the political process from accountability. We did a study in New York State, for example, that found that the campaign finance system had more to do with why incumbents don't get challenged than the gerrymandering. And we need to tap the voter and public disgust at the flood of money that's come in the wake of Citizens United, the disgust at the diminution in judicial independence that we've seen with the campaign fundraising, the general sense that government is broken, and situate this as part of that. Nobody's ever marched in the street for election administration, and few, maybe they have on redistricting reform, but there have been a lot of marches in the street in the country's history for democracy, and we need to not have this, you know, the prisoner of us lawyers or the jargon, but seen as part of the broader set of things that people may not always understand all the fine print, but they're pretty steamed about these days.
Mm-hmm. Great.
I would say we probably spend about 35% of our time on education and public education. We do a lot of litigation and policy work as well. But that 35% is more than we used to spend. And so on that Redrawing the Lines website, redrawingthelines.org, we have a PSA targeted at minority communities to understand why redistricting matters, how it affects them, and why it's important. We travel the nation speaking to local chapters of African American groups, branches of the NAACP, which is a separate organization, but across the nation, who are going to engage on the ground in the redistricting process. And our lawyers travel across the nation to speak to them and help them engage, and to other communities as well. Additionally, our lawyers have spoken to legislators to help them understand what the rules are. In many places, we have term limits. There are people without the knowledge of how it all works. One way to look at it is that that's a very good thing. Another way to look at it is that that's a frightening thing, because they may not understand all of the constrained choices, including the legal requirements that prevent them from running roughshod over minority communities. And so our lawyers have been out there and in those processes. And indeed, we've been invited out to speak to some of these independent redistricting commissions to help educate the people who are going to be picking the members to sit on the commission, to help them understand what's at stake and that it's a multifaceted process. So I think that would be my answer on the public education. As to the Posner piece, that the problem with the suggestion is then political parties under the current jurisprudence would have super First Amendment rights, because they would have all the First Amendment rights of political parties plus the First Amendment rights of corporations, and so they would then be immune to suit of any kind. I'm joking a bit, but I think that Michael is right, that it would be difficult in practice to implement. And in terms of the practical things, there is no substitute for grabbing the resources and getting educated and joining up with civic groups or communities, local organizations that want to be a part of it, and then reach out, make us work, make other people that have a duty, the state legislatures, if they're independent redistricting commissions, get on the phone and force them to come talk to the people about the process. I think that's really a necessary tool, because that's the building block.
With respect to the first, it's a major issue of concern, particularly because we have a growing community that's dispersed across the country. And there's no conceivable circumstance under which I will have enough resources to have lawyers or even outreach coordinators integrally involved in putting together coalition unity maps in every jurisdiction that would be of concern. So we've really got to depend on educating the community, non-lawyer community, to be engaged in this process and be able to try to put together their own coalition maps and then to identify problems that occur and bring them to our attention if they are potentially ripe for a legal challenge. So it's really a matter of great concern to me, particularly this time around. I got a call a few months ago from a minister in Philadelphia who wanted me to commit that we would be involved in Philadelphia city redistricting. I mean, we focused here on congressional and to some extent state legislative, but this is going to go on in city councils and school boards and county boards, in smaller jurisdictions across the country. And I had to tell this minister, you know, I'm happy to go myself or send someone to do a little bit of training, but I have to be honest with you, there's absolutely no set of circumstances under which I will have the resources to devote someone to Philadelphia city redistricting. So it's a major concern. With respect to Posner, my answer is similar. I think right now it's not a viable theory. Two things that I would say, one tongue-in-cheek, like Debo, maybe after Citizens United we get some corporations running for office, maybe the lines will be blurred, and you know, who knows what might become possible. But the other thing is, you know, in the Texas case that went to the Supreme Court a few years ago, the issue that they didn't resolve, and they've ducked a lot of issues in this area, but the issue they didn't resolve was whether they would ever step in on political redistricting, that they would find partisan gerrymandering so objectionable that they would conclude that it violates the Constitution. They didn't go there. Will they eventually go there? I don't know. They've left a lot of issues open, including, and I'll say this because I know David would want it brought up, I mean, there's still an open question about whether Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires preclearance of redistricting for huge portions of the country, will still be a viable tool to ensure that redistricting is fair. And that's been left open by the Supreme Court, and it's certainly going to be teed up by this redistricting process. And finally, with what are the concrete things? Demand transparency, demand lack of conflict of interest and bias from whoever the line drawers are, and demand input. And I think that's just encapsulating what everyone else has said here.
Great. Wonderful. It's a great closure. So I want to thank all of our panelists. Please join me in thanking them. And especially to thank Jeff for making this film that hopefully will broaden out this debate from this little room. So thanks so much for joining us. Mm-hmm.